find your forte.
Live your forte.
Welcome to another Finding Your Forte podcast. It's Seeps. Just wanted to say thank you to everyone that's been listening as of recent. I haven't thanked you guys in a while. I was looking at the analytics and whatnot, and I can't lie, they were humbling. You know, seeing that so many people listen to it, listen to the episodes regularly. You know, the fact that I can see who's listening, you know, big up all of you. I appreciate it. It's always good to kind of share journeys, but also share my own. Today, I have a very special guest. They've got a very interesting and niche background, which is the reason why they've caught my interest. But at the same time, I feel like they fit the model of what Finding Your Forte is about, the fact that they've found what their forte is and they're running with it. So this person is within the field of equestrian. For those that don't know, that involves horses, but that is a very uncultured way of me to, you know, describe it. But my guest is called Ray, and I'll introduce and allow her to take over. How are you, Ray?
I'm good, thanks.
How's your day been?
It's been tiring, but it's been good. I've been training all day. So yeah, that's what I've been doing.
So you've been training as in jumping horses or?
No. So I do two things in terms of training. Mm-hmm. I train for myself, like to actually ride. Mm-hmm. And also I have a few clients, I train their horses.
Okay.
So I will typically, like, if I'm not, because I work two jobs, I do that and then I have another job. So if I'm not working that day, like my other job, I will wake up around 6 o'clock. I like to train early because I feel like that's when I'm like most.
So you're a morning person?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's weird though, because I used to think I prefer training in the evening, but I prefer training in the morning. But anyway, yeah, I'll train in the morning and then around 11, I might have my first client come in, I'll train their horse. I'll either exercise them, so I'll have them on a lunge, which is like a long rope, and okay, you just like get them to run around and exercise them and just different transitions and whatnot. Or I'll actually ride them, but that's like training them to do like certain things rather than just exercising.
Okay.
And then I might have a few hours free just to do whatever I'm doing. Then I might train another horse, and then it just depends on how I really feel. I'll either train again, mm-hmm, or I will go to the gym. But typically, I'd be riding 4 or 5 horses a day.
Wow.
Yeah, it's intense.
So let's break down equestrian for the basics,
because okay,
I'm sure there's a lot of people that, I guess, not quite sure what it is. They've probably seen it at the Olympics.
Yeah.
Or they may have a false concept of what it actually involves. So how would you describe equestrian? It's not
equestrianism.
Is it an ism?
Yeah.
It's an ism. Okay,
equestrian. Cool, okay. But it's like such like a broad, because you have your different disciplines like jumping, dressage, polo, eventing, cross country. There's like so many different.
So which ones are the ones that you kind of specialize in?
I specialize in hunter jumper, which is huntsie, which is a type of English saddle. So I do show jumping. But that is also split into two different, it's like there's so many different like subsections. So I do that, and there's two that I do. Huntsie is you're judged on your turnout and like your posture. Mm-hmm. And then jumping is more about clearing the fences in a certain amount of time. Like that's just straight out speed type jumps. Yeah. And then apart from actual riders, there's people who work like on the yard. So you have your instructors, your grooms, your stable hands. Like it's just such like a broad spectrum.
So I'd imagine that there's a lot that goes into being an equestrian rider.
Definitely, definitely.
So how did you get into that? Because it's not something that someone.
No, it's weird. Like first of all, my mum, she's always had us doing three things from when we're young. One sport, one language, and one instrument. And I remember I must have been about 6. I've always loved horses, but I must have been about 6. And there was a stables near us. And I'd beg her, like, let me ride, let me ride, let me ride. And she'd be like, no, you're not old enough, you're not old enough. So on my 7th birthday, she finally allowed me to ride. It's actually funny because I hated riding for like the first 3 months. But I realized it's not that I hated riding. I just hated that school because it sounds weird as someone who's around animals, but I hate like dirt and muck. But that riding school was like filthy. I'm like big on presentation when it comes to you riding and the actual yard. I like when it's clean, I can see that people are keeping up to standards. Mm. But that yard was just like horrible. I hate it for like 3 months, but my mum's like big on commitment. She's like, if you choose this, you have to stick with it. So she kind of like just forced me to stick with it. And then she found another yard and I moved that. And it was just like, this is what I love. This is the time of my life. I never want to leave. I want to like, I literally, like in my free time, I'd be like, yeah, mom, like I'm going to the yard. And she's like, you're 8 years old. How are you getting there if I'm not driving? I'm like, I'll find a way. And luckily in my prep school, there was another girl who rode at that same yard. Mm-hmm. So we kind of had like a carpool system. So whenever I wanted to go there, if her mom was available, she'd take me. If she wanted to go there and my mom was available, she'd take me. And that's just kind of like how it flourished.
So this was something that I guess you wanted to do and your parents, particularly your mom, encourage you to do as well.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
you had to stick with it.
Basically. Like my mum's big on commitment. It's not even just horse riding, anything. She's like, if you want me, you know, to support you in this, like, there's no change in your mind. Like, you have to stick with it. So, you know, choose wisely.
How did you kind of, I guess for me is that, I guess me growing kind of in a city, it's not something that you hear quite often of someone doing equestrianism. So what was the kind of route of entry for you? Was like, how did you discover where, how did you or your mum discover where to go? Was it just something within your area or community that you could find?
Well, we always knew there was like a yard near us, but it's just like with anything really, it's, if you want to do it, you just sort of, you know, Google it or ask around and find out like, how do I do this? Where do I go? And then you just sort of take it from there.
Mm. Was that, so what that was actually about horses or about that, that actually sparked you to say to your mum, I want to do this?
I think I just always liked horses. So it just got to a point where it's like, just petting a horse is just not enough for me. Like, I want to actually like be around this.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, like even when I was younger, it wasn't just riding. Like I would help at the yard, like on Saturdays or half term on holidays. Like I would just go down and just help with the horses just to be around them because that's just what I loved.
Mm.
They bring like a sense of calmness to me. It's weird. Like for me, riding isn't just like, it's therapy for me. I find it very relaxing. They're very like intuitive animals as well. They sort of feed off your energy. And I just love that.
That's interesting. Cause this is going to be a completely different contrast in terms of how I see it. I guess for me, because obviously when I used to work in a bookies now, this is, and I hope this doesn't come as any disrespect to
No, 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 I've heard everything.
Like for me, it's like when I used to see like jockeys and horses and this, that and the other, it's like the same thing you're talking about in terms of like, you know, them being very intuitive animals.
Yeah.
In terms of the commentary and whatnot, when you used to kind of, when I used to listen to it or had to listen to it, they used to always talk about like the jockey and horse relationship and saying that that's more of the winning formula more than the actual training of the
100%,
horse.
100%,
100%. And I guess that seems to translate within, you know, within equestrianism as well, where your relationship with the horse is developed. Do you tend to keep the same horse for a fixed period of time? or
as someone who, like, rides, I don't want to say professionally because I'm not quite there yet. Like, let me say semi-professionally.
Speak it.
I would definitely say, like, the more advanced riders, you will see that they do tend to stick with the same horse. Even if they don't own a horse, if they're just at riding school or they're leasing a horse, they will train with that horse for a period of time.
Okay.
I think the only time you really see people, like, switching horses is maybe if they're a beginner rider or they just haven't found a horse that can stick with them, that they haven't built a bond. Because the thing is with, especially in show jumping, there needs to be like a mutual respect and bond between you and the horse. Otherwise, you're just not going to clear the course the way that you want to.
So does the horse pick you or do you pick the horse?
I think it goes both ways, you know, because I've been at yards and I feel like the horses picked me. Maybe I didn't feel like I was ready for the horse, but the horse sort of maybe trusted me more than I trusted him.
Okay.
But that goes back to even like of riding schools, they have horses that they call schoolmasters. And basically they'll give them to beginner horses because they know the horse knows its job and it knows to trust the person on them. So that sort of is like a confidence builder for the rider, just to have that trust in the horse. So then they're ready to move on to something more green. And when we say green horse, it's something that's like, it's a horse that's not as trained. But when they ride them, it'll be like a mutual beneficial thing. They'll learn how to ride a horse that's not a schoolmaster.
Mm.
And that horse will learn how to really listen to a rider.
I hear that. I feel like with this realm in itself, I mean, you mentioned something about how you can own a horse or you could lease a horse. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much of a difference does that make? Is it easier to lease a horse than it is to own a horse? Is it more, well, clearly it's going to be more expensive to own one.
But financially, definitely more expensive to own a horse, but I don't think there's much difference because in terms of like building a bond, it's exactly the same. And then again, it depends on what type of lease you have as well. If you're leasing straight from an owner, then that's basically like having your horse. But if you're leasing from like a riding school, a lot of the times you won't be the only person riding and handling that horse. So I don't want to say it's not as strong as a bond, but the horse might just be like whatever because he's just so used to touch it, like so many different people touching it and handling it.
I guess it can relate to even like people sometimes.
Definitely.
You know, like too many people. I guess you know, like with kids, when your kid's around too many people, they get kind of flustered and they don't really know who to kind of gravitate towards.
Definitely.
But if you've got a kid that kind of sticks to one adult, a lot of the time they build that kind of bond.
Definitely. I would sort of say the same. I always compare, like, people always hate it when I compare animals and pets to kids, but I do think it's like very similar, like especially in terms of commitment and having that animal or that child rely on you. Like a lot of people, they think, oh, if you have a horse, like it's whatever, but I'm like, no, it's not, because if I don't want to get up tomorrow morning and I decide to lie in, that's not really an option. Because that horse is, you know, at the stables, it has to get fed, it has to get ridden. I might have to call in the vet or the ferry. And like, at the end of the day, I have to put that horse first. It's more than just me. So I kind of do like compare it to children. It's like, it's a responsibility. You know, you've chosen to do this, so you just have to stick with it.
So what would a normal like day consist for you when it comes to a horse?
There is no such thing as normal day when it comes to horses. Like a few weeks ago, believe it or not, I've been riding on and off for about 17 years. A few weeks ago, that was the first time I ever had to bandage up my horse. Like he got turned out in the night, which means he got put into the field.
Okay.
So I came in the next morning, one of the stable hands brought him in and his leg was just slashed open. I don't know what he did. But it was slashed open and I had to like disinfect it and clean it and I was so proud of myself. I was like, I should have gone to, you know, vet school. I was so proud of myself. But yeah, there's no such thing as normal day with horses. But let's say a typical day. Let's just say hypothetically. Go in. They've been turned out. You bring them in. Get breakfast ready. I might groom them depending on what state they're in, what time of the year it is. Around this time of the year in the winter, I don't really clip their hair that much, so then they're not too cold. Feed them. I might lunge them or put them on the walker, bit of exercise. Then if I'm riding them, I'll tack them up, put all the saddle, bridle, everything on, ride them. Then they'll get a bit of a break. There's no typical day. It's just, that's just like the main thing. And then I might clean, do a bit of cleaning around the yard. That's one thing I hate, mucking out, like cleaning the stalls.
Do you get used to it at any point?
I've definitely become somewhat desensitized to horse poo. It's really weird because when you think about it, horse poo is just, it's just smelly grass.
It must be so pungent as well.
It is. But you sort of just get desensitized to it. But I don't enjoy mucking out though.
So there seems like a lot that goes into it.
It's hard work.
Yeah.
Like, if you go to the stables, like, the people who work on the yard, like, you will not find a fat person. Like, it's physically intensive.
Yeah, no, definitely. Because my colleague at work, she grew up around horses.
Yeah.
And I think she has her own horse.
Mm.
And she's always coming into work, like, exhausted. But yeah. She's probably the most fittest person in the office.
Definitely.
Probably because of how much she has to put in labour of just maintaining the horse, let alone riding it.
Definitely.
It's like, there's so much things that you have to carry the food.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, the manure and everything, just you need to sweep it up.
Even just mucking out is like doing arms day, literally. When I say that, like, riding is literally going to the gym, it's intensive. Like, there are days I'll just come home and I can't even just walk up the stairs. I'm like, my legs are a complete write-off. Like, I'm tired. I can't do this.
So you do this full time?
Yeah.
Have you always done it full time?
No.
So what did you do prior to doing it full time?
Well, I was in university, but I dropped out of my second year because it just was not going. I mean, it was going well, but it just was not what I wanted to do.
What motivated that decision?
I just was not happy, really. Like, I was good at what I was doing. I studied biochemistry, but I just realised it wasn't something I was doing for me. I was doing it for my parents. And I was just kind of like, well, why am I here wasting my time? Because I'm not going to use this after. Like, let me just try focus on finding what I want to do.
Mm. And how did your parents take that, to say that you wanted to go into...
I mean,
this very niche, you know.
I didn't even go straight into this, you know. That's the funny thing. But my mum was kind of like, well, I don't know what you want me to say. Like, obviously, I'm not happy, but I can't force you to do what you don't want to do. Mm. My dad was sort of like, well, whatever you want to do, I'm going to support you. Just make sure, you know, you find something you want to do before, like, you know, you're 30 years old and you're at home doing nothing. Yeah. Right.
I hear that. So when you actually decided to do this full time, what was the kind of process prior to that? Because before we were speaking, you know, off mic, you were kind of talking about how you kind of made that decision. You didn't unknowingly and knowingly made that decision. So what was the kind of period, that transitional period in it, sense saying that actually I'm going to do this full time?
It's weird because I've always been riding on and off. I was actually competing, like, my quote unquote junior career. I say that because I don't really call it a career. Like, I've actually done a lot more then than now. But I've always been doing that, and I've been doing other bits and pieces. And then I'll stop riding for like 6 months, and then I'll come back, and then I'll stop. And then, so it just got to a point where I was kind of like, I've tried all these things and I don't really enjoy it, but I keep coming back to horses. Like, this is clearly meant to be. Like, I don't know why I keep fighting this. So I just sort of thought, this is what I want to do. Let me make a plan, figure out what exactly is what I want to do. Do I want to compete? Do I want to teach? Do I want to be, you know, a trainer? Let me figure out what exactly I want to do. And then it was actually last year the penny finally drops, because I was in New York. I was doing an A&R internship. And I was riding at Riverdale Stables, and there's a rider, like a big rider out there called Kent Barrington. And I actually had a clinic with him. And after I did that, I was kind of like, why am I doing this internship? Like, this is not what I want to do. Like, clearly this is not for me. And then when I came home from America, I sort of sat my mum down. I was like, listen, I know this is, like, even for anyone, like, getting into this professionally is hard. I said, I know this, you probably won't see the vision straight away, but, you know, I have the experience. You know, I've been doing this since I was young. This is what I want to do. And my mum was like, okay, like, if this is generally what you want to do, we're going to sit down, we're going to, you know, write a list of things you need to do, make a plan of action, and take it from there. And, like, it was just surprising to me that she sort of supported it off jump as a professional career rather than just a hobby. I was kind of like, wow, you're actually on board. I thought I would have to convince you a lot more. But obviously, it's just taken off from there, really.
How important was it for your mum to be supportive? Because I feel like a lot of people, when they do quite frankly, alternative career choices, you know, things that are a niche, things that go beyond traditional convention. Parents can be quite reluctant because they want to go for the safeguarded option. They want to go for the, you know, the option that most people know that there's a larger guarantee of it being at least financially rewarding. And I know equestrianism, when you get to the upper echelons, it can be very rewarding. Yeah. But to get to that point, it's very difficult. So how important was that?
I think for my mum, she was definitely reluctant. But I think because she knows how passionate I am about horses, it was kind of like she trusts that I know, or at least have an idea of what I want to do, that I will be all right. Mm. I think if it was a case of me not having any experience, she'd be like, you're crazy. I'm like, find something else to do. But the fact that I do have experience and somewhat have a foot in the door already, mixed in with that passion, she's just kind of like, well, I'm just going to support you because obviously you have an idea of what you're doing. I trust that you'll find the right path. And that was it, really. My dad was pretty much the same. He was like, well, you know, you've done a lot of competitions already, so, you know, you're not starting from scratch. I'll support you how I can.
And was that commitment or support, by and large, required a lot of financial backing?
It's a bit of both, really, financial and emotional. But for me, it was the emotional support was a lot more important to me
than the financial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the financial as well, I'm obviously, like I said, I train other people's horses and I have clients that I work with. That helps me a lot with in terms of what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a mix, really. I never expected them to support me financially. Like when I came to my mum about this, I just sort of explained, I just wanted to let her know what my game plan was. And I just thought it would be more emotional, but I appreciate both, really.
That's interesting. I think it's always nice to hear when you come across parents who are really willing to encourage and go behind their child with whatever their endeavours are. I think nowadays, I think parents are a lot more apt in doing that than maybe parents from maybe like 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Definitely.
Because I feel like now they kind of see the new world and what the new world opportunities are, where the old world, the old money was basically lawyer, doctor, accountant.
Definitely. That was one thing was sort of scared about bringing to my parents, because I know that I'm Nigerian, so I know a lot of parents are kind of like, you want to be an athlete, you want to be a musician, you want to be a DJ, you want to be a photographer, like, my friend, go and read your books. Like, so I was kind of nervous about that. I thought my mom would be like, instead of you to go and finish your degree, like, what are you doing? But I'm like happy that she supported that. Like, even the other day, I was talking to one of my work colleagues, and her brother, he's a pilot. And pilot school is like,
it's crazy.
It's insane.
Yeah.
So her parents were like, well, if you want to be a pilot, get a degree first. So at least if that doesn't work out, you have something to fall back on. So he went to university, got his economy degree, and then they trust him so much that he's so committed to being a pilot that he got a loan against their house to pay for pilot. Like, it's insane to me. Like, but I think it's good at the same time that you trust and you support your child enough to take that kind of risk.
That is a major risk.
Major risk. But like, when she told me that, I was just like, what? Like, your parents like really rock with your brother if that's the type of risk they're trying to take. Like, it's just insane.
I think the more risk parents are willing to take in terms of backing their child, it's not even the financial backing that will reap the rewards. It's
100%.
It's actually the confidence
100%
that gives the child or their child the esteem. 100%. A lot of times you hear no from your parents. You hear no, you can't do
this. And it just shuts you down completely.
And you probably hear no more at home than you do
outside.
You know how you always have those people that are like, oh, my teacher always said they'll never make it. Realistically speaking, you probably heard it more at home
your parents,
than you did. You heard it at school.
Definitely.
Because, to be fair, teachers very rarely say that as explicitly as that you're never going to make it in life. They may say, if you don't work hard enough, you're not going to do well. Your parents will say to you something
you'll end up in McDonald's.
They'll say something as real as that. And then you're like, boy, that you get shut down.
You're right.
Do you know what I'm saying? So it's very nice to hear those kinds of things. And I think that as even when we become parents, because we're kind of more exposed to this kind of new world of opportunities.
Definitely.
And because we want to right the wrongs that we may have not had when our parents are trying to raise us, because quite frankly, I feel like a lot of parents were just surviving. It may 100%. Not necessarily be the case, you know, it varies from parent to parent, yeah. But I think like a by and large pool of most people's parents, depending on your kind of socio-economical background,
yeah,
you were surviving. They were just trying to get you from A to B, Monday to Friday, Saturday, Sunday, to get to the next week.
I definitely agree. And I think even when they weren't just surviving, I think a lot of our parents have like different mentalities mm-hmm. compared to us now. So, you see people, like, they'll say certain things like happened in their childhood and you're like, I will never do that to my child. Like, regardless of their background, you just think I would, like, that's not the right way to approach it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just always a case of, with each generation, us learning something new, you know, in ways to support our children, not even just financially, maybe emotionally, you know, just to make sure that they're healthy and, you know, given the right, I don't know how to say, like the right things they need to operate in the world in a healthy manner.
The right tools, I guess.
Yeah.
I think more than anything, the right environment. I think now as well, touching on that point, is that I feel like now there's much more of a dialogue and a conversation about emotive well-being of a child, mental well-being of a
yes.
child. Sometimes it can go a bit off on a tangent when we go a bit extreme with it.
Yeah.
But I think there's a much more conscious effort, like definitely. Of a lot of people now who are new parents, they're much more intuitive and they're much more mindful of how their child feels. A child is just not an object anymore. It's just like, I have to raise this being because I had 5 minutes of pleasure and this is the outcome of it. Like, they're actually like, this is a real genuine human being from the get-go. Where I think sometimes that was maybe lost in previous generations where children were seen but never heard.
Definitely.
Children are now being listened to a bit more. Sometimes too much, because sometimes you just need to tell a kid to shut up because, you know, they need that tough love as well. Not tough love in terms of beating them senseless, but they need that
just kind to let them know that sometimes I just
the rough with the smooth. Yeah, the rough with the smooth, as I like to call it. But it's really nice to kind of hear that kind of thing. But now going into the next chapter, which is, I guess, more the more present day.
Mm-hmm.
So you said you've been kind of inconsistent in and out of it. And now you've kind of dedicated yourself to this. For how long would you say?
I want to say
Full time,
probably since August, end of August. I want to say full time.
So from August to now, you've been full time with what you do in terms of equestrianism.
Yeah.
And now, are you looking to compete? Are you looking? What is the next endeavor now? Like, what does full time mean?
I'm actually going off to Florida on the 25th. Going. This is my first international competition ever.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like big for me. I'm going to the Winter Equestrian Festival.
Mm-hmm.
That's at Wellington in Florida, and it's like amazing. It's like a big, big competition. It runs for 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. I'm only going for 2 weeks though.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like amazing. So I'm like really excited for that. My two horses actually just got shipped over there last week. So yeah, I miss them already.
Wow. But so who looks after them when they're over there?
So when they're in Florida, there's stables that they stay at while I'm competing. But at the moment, they're in quarantine.
What does that mean?
So whenever like animals or livestock are like moved to another state or another country, they're sort of just like held for a certain period of time.
Okay.
In case they have like any diseases or whatnot, just to see how it is. But mm-hmm. they're fine, so they'll be released when I get there.
Cool.
So, yeah.
How do you kind of get into the competing world? Is there like, I'm coming as a blank canvas, so you got to break it down to the basics.
Okay, so it depends where you're starting from, really. A lot of times people sort of buy their way in, but in the equestrian world, like that's not respected. Like people, like we laugh at people who pretty much buy their way in. It's very obvious that they're not there on talent. You can just tell by the way they ride that it's just all over the place. But really it just starts, you can start at your local stables and then move up to like regionals, and then they have like big shows around England. They have Horse of the Year, there's Hickster, there's All England Jumping, Olympia. There's so many different ways you can do that. And then, you know, you just move up and up really. And I know Grand Prix, you can't enter. You have to be invited to that. Like, that's like the upper echelon type competitions. It's just, you know, working your way up, really.
So where, what you're competing at now, what level is that?
I'm competing at CS 2 and 3 star, which is, it's not far from Grand Prix, but it's like three stars away, but it's like a big jump though. Like,
right, so if I was to put it in football terms now,
it's like,
so it's, there's Premier League, which is probably Grand Prix, right?
Yeah.
So would you say, was it CS3, right? CS2, what was it called? CSI 2 and 3.
I would say,
Would you say that's below or three levels below?
Three levels below.
So that's what? League 2. Okay, so that puts in perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. So there's Premier League, Championship, League 1, League 2.
League 2, yeah, that makes sense.
Cool,
yeah.
That's fine. Is it? And then how do you kind of get up to being in Grand Prix?
You just work your way up, really. Like, you move up slowly, slowly, slowly. But then Grand Prix, like I said, you're invited to that. You can't, it's not a case of just entering.
Okay, so is it quite exclusive?
Yeah.
And is it sort of, how do you get the attention of those to invite you in? Is it just purely on performance?
It's just purely on performance, really. Like, they have people who are always watching shows anyway. Like, just not just America, Europe, just everywhere. That's pretty much what I'm trying to do now. I'm trying to, like, make a name and get that kind of recognition. I've already been recognised by the Longines Masters. So, like, that's a good... I'm actually competing there in New York in April, which is, like, amazing. I was so excited about that. But I'm just sort of, like, trying to get my name out there at the moment. It's fun.
That's interesting. I think it'll be interesting to see how your name flourishes. And I look forward to seeing that. I guess for me, like, a curious question for me is, I guess, getting into it, I'd imagine that looking from the outside in, from what I guess what I've seen on TV, is that it's a very white-dominated sport. Now, with you being a black woman, that's doubling down.
Yeah.
How has that experience been for you? Because all I've mostly seen in the equestrian world is either white men or white women, and probably more men than women.
Definitely. It's like a dynamic. When you get to the higher levels of riding, it's heavily male dominated. Like, I was looking at the FAI rankings the other day, and I think it was like 5 women in the top 50. Like, that's insane. And then on top of that, none of them are black. But personally, I never like noticed it, because to me, when I'm at the stable, it's about the horses. I'm not really looking at people like, oh, he's white, he's black, he's rich, he's poor. For me, I'm just there to do what I'm doing. I never really noticed it until people pointed it out to me. And then I was kind of like, why aren't there any people? Like, I actually remember mentioning it to my friend the other day. I was like, every time I see a black man at the yard, it's not because he's riding, it's because he's dropping off his child there. And most of the times they're mixed race. Like, I've never really seen any full black children. And I'm like, this is really bizarre. I want to see more people like me at the yard. And I think that's also probably why I want to compete for Nigeria, because I know there is an equestrian community in Nigeria. They just don't really see it as something to do professionally, or even as leisure. They're just sort of like, well, whatever, I'll have a polo horse at the, you know, the polo club, but I'll pay someone else to ride it for me. And I'm just sort of like, why? Like, you know, you have the resources there, use it.
Do you feel like there is an appetite within, say, for example, the black community for this, where you just feel like this is something that they're just not exposed to?
I don't know about appetite, but I feel like a lot of black people, they have like maybe like perceptions of it. So they think like it's for white people because they don't see many black people. So I feel like I want to be that one, that person to expose and be like, hey, like, it's for everyone.
Yeah.
If you're good at it, you're good at it. You know, go for it. It shouldn't put you off because you think it's for one type of person.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think you mentioned an interesting point in terms of when you refer to like Nigeria, and you say that there's like a strong, you know, maybe there's an interest there, or maybe there's more likely for there to be a more gravitating interest there. And that, like, you did mention that you would like to compete for Nigeria. What is it about Nigeria that kind of gives you that inkling, or that is it experience? Is it, what is it that's made
you feel that way? I've been to Nigeria, I've been to Lagos, and they have a big big polo like community out there. Mm. Like, it's big. I also know like a few people who own horses out there, and I'm like, well, you guys ride, like, why wouldn't you want to ride? You ride well as well, you know, you play in Africa, and why wouldn't you want to do this on, like, you know, an international scale? I think a lot, like I said, like we said before, a lot of parents sort of like, well, go and be a doctor, go and be a lawyer, go and be an accountant. I feel like a lot of the time it's just a case of breaking the mold and showing them like you can do this seriously and be taken seriously.
I hear that. So I understand that you're creating a equestrian organization, federation, foundation.
So there's two things I'm in the process of doing. The federation, that's taking forever to do. But the association, Equestrian Association of Nigeria, we've created that. And that's being affiliated with the FEI. So that means that I can now compete whilst representing Nigeria.
Okay.
Which is like a big thing. I've actually been talking to one of the ladies over there since like 2016. So it's kind of cool to see like it's actually like come to fruition now. Like, I've been emailing her back and forth, like, what do I do? Is there any way I can compete without this, that and the other? And I'm not going to lie to you, like, Nigeria is very disorganized at times. So this has been a bit, you know, stressful to put together.
What's the learning curve been like? What have you learned along the way while setting this up? Because it doesn't sound like, if Nigeria is anything like India, it feels like there's no right way, and it's based on who you know, not what you know.
What I've learned is you need to be assertive. Like, a lot of the time you need to, like, be very specific about what you want and how you want it. And when, like, you just need to be very assertive.
Does connections help?
I don't think so, to be honest with you. I thought it would help, but it's...
isn't that much disorganized.
Yeah. Yes, it's...
Wow.
But the one good thing I will say is there's a riding school out there, and I've contacted them regarding setting this up. And what I also wanted to do is sort of use that riding school as like a training grounds for anyone who wants to compete for Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's been a good looking out. They've helped me with that. I think I've got a lot of people who've come to offer support, a lot more people than I would expect would come to at least offer me support. So that's good. I think, because for me, I've always like sort of like made it a big point for me that I want to be the first international show jumper. So people have always thought, yeah, like this is a good idea. You know, it's a moment in history for Nigeria. So I think that's sort of like, you know.
So no one's represented Nigeria before for in equestrianism?
There is no equestrian federation, nothing. There's polo, but in terms of show jumping, dressage, eventing, nothing.
So would this mean that by representing Nigeria under this federation association, you would then be able to quote unquote potentially compete in the Olympics?
Definitely.
And is that something you aspire to do?
That is definitely something I aspire to do. Yeah, that's
is that like the peak of goals for you?
Definitely, yeah.
Is it simply to compete? Well, obviously you'd want to win gold, and
yeah,
you know, you will achieve gold, amen. But at the same time, like, what's the difference between I should phrase it differently. When you do typically compete, you compete as your own person rather than for a nation.
Yeah.
And in what instances beyond Olympics do you compete as a nation?
Well, if you're competing internationally anyway, you're representing your country, but...
So currently, who are you representing?
At the moment, it's weird, because at the moment, I don't compete for a country. Before, in my junior career, I competed for Great Britain.
Okay.
But at the moment, I don't compete for a country. I compete under the FEI flag. And it's kind of like, I don't know how to explain it. It's like for people who don't have a country to represent.
It's
kind
of like an Olympics when you're like kind of seen as like a quote unquote alien with no nation. Okay, that's interesting. So how far do you feel like you are away from officially competing for Nigeria?
Well, hopefully, we're thinking that when I go to New York in April, I should be competing for Nigeria then.
Okay.
So it should be all finally.
And so next Olympics 2020, right?
Yeah, but I don't think I'm going to make that, to be honest, because there's a lot that I need to achieve before then.
Mm.
And I don't think I'm going to do that in like a year and a half. It doesn't sound very realistic. I mean, I will push, but it just doesn't sound very realistic.
At the same time, it's good to be optimistic as well. It is to be pragmatic.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it seems like you're putting the rules in motion.
Mm.
I guess for me, it's more of the motivational aspect, because it feels like you're almost doing this as like a one woman band. How much of a strain does that put on you psychologically? Because I guess there's so many factors to consider, and the fact that you're doing this, something that doesn't exist for a nation.
Yeah.
You know, you are, in by no short of terms, pioneering in this.
Yeah.
I mean, that must be, A, quite overwhelming at times, but B, what kind of strain does that put on you, motivation-wise? Or just mentally?
I mean, at times, it is kind of draining, because I know that some Nigerians, they won't take it seriously, and it's kind of like, I'm representing the country. Like, it's... You should be happy that someone is finding another avenue to represent your country. Because I know when they do see that silver or that gold, they'll be like, hey, my fellow Nigerian. I'll be like, listen, you weren't supposed to be then. Like, what's going on? But, I mean, sometimes it does feel like kind of like, why am I not getting the support that I feel like I should be getting? But then again, it's kind of like, I'm at the end of the day, I am doing this for myself. Like, this is what I want to do. So I have to be my own motivation. I shouldn't have to rely on others.
Mm. I guess it touches on the topic of, in terms of like support and the entitlement of support. I feel like I've touched on this kind of before, but I guess in your regard, it's, you sometimes have to be single-minded.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes you have to put self-interest first more than the utilitarian greater good, wider good of like how this benefits everybody else. And I guess it's something that you kind of touched on early in terms of like you wanting to represent being a young black woman, that it makes it an accessible face.
Yeah.
You know, for people, for others to follow suit and feel like this is a comfortable environment for you to go to, while it is white and white women dominated.
Mm.
And I guess it touched on that representation topic that's kind of cropped up as of recent times quite a lot with, you know, Black Panther, the Londoner ads, and you know, there's all these things that transpire. I mean, what has your been thought in terms of the whole representation dialogue with your personal experience in mind, where you are actually doing it with you understand the importance of representation, but now you're seeing a kind of like an inverse argument, you know, with things that are happening with, you know, the release of Black Panther, with the London Nike Londoner advert? Like, what is your kind of take on the whole representation discourse?
I mean, I sort of see like both sides of the coin, because I understand that obviously representation matters, but you can't expect representation where it doesn't exist, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, even with the Londoner ad, I was so excited to see a black kid on a horse. Like, that was just amazing. Even though it was only like half a second, like, it was amazing to me, because you never see any black people on horses. Like, that was amazing to me. But if that wasn't in the ad, it's not something that I would have pushed for, because there aren't that many black people who do horse ride, which is sort of where I come in. I want to push that, not just for representation. I just want black people to be out there trying different things. Even if it's not horse riding, if it's, you know, skiing or doing anything that they wouldn't typically do, I would love to push for that.
Mm.
So in that respect, I kind of understand why, you know, like, with the Londoner ad, how, like, a lot of the Asians were saying, why aren't there any, you know, Asian people being represented? It's kind of like, well, I mean, if you think about it, there should be, but at the same time, there's not that many of you that are into sports like that. I think it's a cultural thing.
Yeah, it's bollocks. It's bollocks.
But at the same time, if that's how you feel, you should be pushing people in your community to do that.
I think it's multifactorial, and I think from my perspective, when I saw that kind of, I'll call it a discussion in the most polite way that I unfolded to see online, and Lord knows that for me it was time to employ the highest amount of diplomacy. I think for me, looking from within the culture and from looking at it, just I guess from a different vantage point, it's what you touch on in terms of the fact that there isn't many that Nike could particularly draw from. I think to boil it down, it boils down into two points. I think it is it's a right question to ask.
Mm-hmm.
However, it was the wrong time to ask it.
Yeah.
And furthermore,
I think they're asking the wrong people.
And you're asking the wrong people, as in the fact of the matter is that the reality is, and I've seen a lot of points being made, and a few points that kind of resonated with me is that the things that were prominent within that Nike advert was London culture, which is by and large black culture.
Mm-hmm.
Black culture was made by black people.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is there was pockets of Asian representation. There was Oriental Asian representation.
Mm.
There was a young black girl, I mean, young Asian girl, sorry, and Rude Kid as well, which the song was, you know, heavily based around.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the concept of why wasn't there more quote-unquote Asian faces, the reality of it is that Nike are likely to have a remit of making things that have a social currency to it, something Definitely. That is recognisable.
Definitely.
The fact of the matter is that
there are no recognisable Asian.
There is none. I mean, you could have put Amir Khan in it, but he's from Bristol. He's not from London.
Right.
Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And furthermore, beyond that, I agree with you. I think it's more of a cultural issue. Now, granted, you could go and say that, you know, systematically you're not encouraged, you know, representation could have had that knock-on effect, but this wasn't the moment to criticise it.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, granted, it's an advert about Londoners, and you could make the points of saying that, oh, the largest group of ethnic minorities is Asian. Oh, you know, there's so many Asian people in London and all these things, but it's not relevant to this time.
Right, it doesn't fall in line with the actual advert.
It doesn't, and it's not, the point of it is to say, these are the recognisable faces.
Definitely.
These are the ones that are going to attract the most eyes. They've got a marketing remit as well.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, every face that was in there that was a prominent face deserved to be there.
Yeah.
And that is not their fault. And I think for a lot of Asian people, when it comes to these things, I quite frankly think from being within the community itself, it's not to say that representation doesn't matter. I just simply think now we've now got the opportunity where we've asked the question of why there isn't, what are we doing about it culturally?
Definitely.
Where my cousin, he was a baller. But the fact of the matter is that his parents, were family business oriented. And he was like, do you know what? Rather than, I don't feel like I'm going to get the support to go to football training. But at the same time, it makes logical sense for me to go help my parents in their shop.
Definitely.
That's more cultural. And these things are bound to change.
Yeah.
And I feel like now with the second and third generation of Asians here, you know, that are now becoming parents and who are now making a more of an active push and are giving their children a bit more creative freedom, you will see these shoots of things appearing. So I think it's just like, it's a right question to ask. It was the wrong time. And asking the wrong people.
Definitely.
And I think that's just always it boils down to. And I think this is an opportunity, I think, for the Asian community particularly, to look introspectively and say,
definitely,
what are we doing? Or what can we do? Or if we know someone that is doing sports, let's kind of help within. Because quite frankly, everything that black people created have been created from the ground.
Yeah.
Be it cultures, they've come from struggle and whatnot. Yeah. Not to be crass about or anything like that. Music, everything has come from underground up. It's never come from top to bottom.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? All these things have come from the bottom down. So this is a moment for them to celebrate. It should have been a moment to celebrate. Yeah. And I think that whole discourse that was brought into it
was unnecessary.
Unnecessary. And I think it disgusted me.
Yeah.
Like, it genuinely disgusted me, the fact that
they can even wait a few days to...
And it wasn't done with tact. It was done with no tact. And a lot of people were asking me what my thoughts were, and there's my 2 pence on the issue.
Yeah.
But moving on from the kind of, I guess, from the representation angle and moving beyond that now, I guess, what are your kind of frustrations when you've been within your realm itself of equestrianism? Like, what are the things that have kind of frustrated you? Is it institutionally, personally, from, you know, I guess you've already touched on support.
Yeah.
Where are the things where you've had experienced maybe a struggle or you've had to persevere with a certain angle?
I would definitely say, like, I've been at some yards, and some yards can be very, very bitchy. Like, if you're not riding at a certain level or you can't do certain things, they just sort of just ignore you or just, you know, sort of like, whatever. That is definitely... like, I think something that's big in the equestrian community, like, snobbery, I would say. it's just like everyone, whether you're a beginner or a professional, like if you're at a riding school or a private yard or whatever, like it's not just you and your horse. Like it's a community, it's basically a family. When you go to a riding school or a yard, you're entering a new family. Everyone should help everyone. So there's just no, there should not be any room for snobbery in that. So I think that's definitely one thing that I have not liked about that community.
But do you think that's maybe, I guess, class oriented?
I don't think it's to do with class at all.
Or the lack of class, but
yeah. I don't think that's to do with class. I think some people just feel like if you're not a good rider, then they just don't want to waste their time with you. Or if you don't maybe do certain things, they just... Because that is another thing within the equestrian community. They have these things that they call like hunter princesses. So if you're not like show jumping or doing dressage, and if you don't have first ribbons or second ribbons, it's sort of, they just don't pay any mind to you. They're like, well, I'm not interested in you because I only ride, you know, first class Dutch Warmbloods, and you're riding like a riding school cob. So I'm not going to pay any attention to you. There's a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
And I just feel like this, like, you're not doing yourself any good because people aren't going to want to work with you. They're just going to call you a diva, and that's it. You're not going to progress anywhere. And the equestrian community is extremely small, not just in England, but around the world. Everyone knows someone who knows someone who knows someone. If you get the title of feeling entitled or being a brat or being stuck up, like, it's quiet for you.
And I guess that, I guess is it more noticeable from those that have quote unquote bought their way in?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
So they're the ones that tend to be the more snobbish ones.
Yeah.
And how do you, like, is there anything that kind of happens, you know, behind closed doors that you do to kind of put them in check? Do you give them a G check in anyway? Like, let them know that, yo, this is, I take this very seriously, you know, you're new to this. To be honest,
I just let them do what they want to do. Like, you're doing yourself at the end of the day, you're doing yourself a disservice, and I shouldn't be the one to have to tell you how, like, you're grown people. I shouldn't have to be the one to tell you this is how it should be or how it shouldn't be. I mean, I might tell children, like, you know, just, you know, be calm, be humble, you know, just focus on what you're here to do. But if you're a grown adult, I'm not going to tell you, like, I shouldn't have to G-check you.
That's actually quite interesting. What kind of virtues do you think equestrianism has taught you and Phil teaches people? Like, in the same way people who do, I guess, maybe football, it teaches them maybe punctuality, it teaches them stuff like that.
Definitely say commitment, discipline, definitely. Because if you have a horse, like, you have to be very disciplined. You can ruin a horse very easily just by not being disciplined and strong in the rules and boundaries you set. Punctuality, definitely. I think these are the main ones, really. Commitment, I mentioned that, didn't I?
I believe you did,
yeah. Commitment, yes.
Is there any other virtues that you didn't realise that you would learn while doing this? Or you're thankful to have learned?
I think the main ones are discipline and commitment.
Did you feel you lacked that prior?
Discipline, definitely. Yeah. I think, especially since doing this full time, I've become very disciplined. Not even just like physically, just in general. If I say I'm going to do this at this time, I'm going to do it. Before, I'd be like, oh, I can do it later, it's cool. But now, like, especially as I'm working two jobs, everything has to be set at a certain time. I have to do this and do that. And if I just don't do it, then I'm just messing up myself. So I think that's definitely something that has worked in my favour. And then commitment, I think it just reinforced it, really, because horse riding, whether it's for leisure or professional or whatever reason you're doing it for, it's a commitment. You have to stick to it. So it's just sort of reinforcing, you know, making plans and actually following through and just continuing doing that.
I hear that. So I guess on that note, would you want to encourage others to do so?
Yeah.
What kind of tips would you give to people in terms of getting into equestrianism, and what kind of direction or guidance can you give them into it?
The first thing I would say definitely is, at first, it can be a lot to like get into, and I know that from experience, like once you get in, you just want to keep going and going and going. Like, it becomes almost like an addiction. So what I would say definitely is, if you do want to ride, like, take your time, find like a good yard.
How do you find a yard?
Like, it's so easy now, obviously, because it's Google and whatnot. You can Google riding schools, whatnot. If you know people, they can, you know, help you out. But I always say, when people are looking for new riding schools, when you go, like, don't go the first time you want to take a lesson. Go look around, ask questions, you know, look at how the horses look, how they react, how, you know, the yard is kept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just be aware, you know. And don't be afraid if you want to switch yards. You know, no one's gonna force you to stay. I would actually encourage people to move around until they find somewhere they like. And then in terms of, like, owning a horse, I would say take that very, very slow, because it's very easy to become overwhelmed, especially if you're a first-time buyer. Like, just take your time. If you need help, don't be afraid to ask for help. A lot of people I've seen will get a horse, they get overwhelmed, they don't know what to do, and they don't ask for help because they feel like they'll be judged. Like, no, people who work there, like, that's why they're there. They will help you. That's why they're paid to be there.
That's true. I feel like a lot of times people, I'm victim of this and culpable of this as well, is asking for help.
Mm.
I think a lot of times we're hard-headed. Certainly, I've been hard-headed, and I think I'm softening up a little bit now. But asking for help seems to be a common theme that a lot of people seem to have when they are venturing into a new realm. They don't know who to ask.
Or they're just embarrassed.
They just don't want to ask. Like, because exactly, embarrassment or just pride.
I used to be like that at the yards, you know. I wouldn't know how to do something and I would just be embarrassed to ask. And it just got to a point, like, when I was riding in the first yard, it got to a point, I was like, I've been here for 2 years. Like, why am I embarrassed to ask? Why am I embarrassed to ask for help? Like, if I can't do something, you know, I'm only 10 years old. I'm not supposed to be able to know how to do this. Let me just ask.
As young as 10, you were stubborn to ask.
I know, because I always ask. I hate asking for help because I just feel like so useless. I'm like, well, like, why do you need to? But it just got to a point, I was like, you know what, I'm gonna mess this up, and this is like a 1200 pound animal. Either I'm gonna die or he's gonna die, so let me just ask for help.
Oh, that's funny. How much does a horse cost, out of curiosity?
There's different levels. It can be anything from like 1,000 to ridiculous prices. Let me just say that.
I know I've seen a couple of horses that can be like $500,000 and stuff.
They're horses that are like, they're Olympic horses. That are like, I think there was one I was looking at the other day. I think it was like 1.8 million
for a horse.
Mm-hmm. But this, I'm saying, like, there's like different levels. You have your like pleasure / pet horses, which you don't ride. They're just sort of like in the pasture enjoying them, so having the best time of their life. They're just there for you to like pet them.
Yeah.
And then you have the professional horses who are there to work, who, you know, run into the higher side of it.
That's cool. I mean, how do you distinguish different breeds of horses? Like, what is a good breed of horse, or what kind of breed of horses are suited for racing, for example, versus
for racing? For racing, it's typically thoroughbreds. And then for what I do, show jumping, it's usually warm bloods or thoroughbreds or a mix.
Okay. So those
those are generally like the elite horses for sports horses.
And is being mixed in horses being like a thoroughbred mixed with a red blood?
Warm blood.
Warm blood, that's the one. See, there we go. I'm learning. Is it a disadvantage to have a mixed horse? Or is it advantageous in some realms?
To be honest, it's not so much the mix. It's so much like the dam and the sire. Okay. So the mother and the dad. Obviously, when you have two elite horses, you breed them together, you're expecting a better horse.
Yeah. Okay.
That's another thing that affects the prices as well. Like who
the mum and dad are. I guess that's like kind of like dogs as well sometimes. Yeah. You know, if you've got a real strong stud, then you know, that person can charge your arm and leg.
Yeah, basically.
I hear that. Would you ever go into breeding?
I don't think so. I just don't really have a desire to go into that, I don't think.
Have you ever seen a horse be born?
Yeah. I've seen a cow being born as well. Both very traumatizing.
That's crazy.
I wanted to be a vet at some point, and then we went to a farm and I saw a cow being born, and I was just like, I'm not about this life. I was like, I am not about this life.
Oh no, that's hilarious. I think there's so much things to, like, I guess, learn, and I've learned so much from speaking to you about equestrianism, about horses, about, I guess, your experience. And I see a very fruitful and very pioneering journey ahead of you. How can people, like, keep track of what you're doing? I know you mentioned that you're doing two shows coming up, one on the 25th and then another one in April.
Yeah, so at the moment, I'm actually going to be taking a break from social media. But if you follow the Equestrian Association of Nigeria, which is EAO Nigeria, we're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. If you follow that, I'm going to be posting everything I get up to. So yeah, that's like the best place to see everything I'm doing.
So that's EAO.
EAO. No, EAO Nigeria.
Yeah.
And that's on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
That's very, very dope. Thank you so much for your time, Ray. I think it's been a lovely conversation, learning about horses, equestrianism, representation, and everything in between. But yeah, that's another Finding Your Forte episode. Follow the socials, The Forte UK on Twitter, The Forte UK on Instagram, myself, Seeps, that's CWPZ. On Twitter, Instagram, follow on SoundCloud, you know, subscribe on iTunes. Everything is there. Look out for the future episodes coming up. I've got some really good guests lined up, just like the one I've had today. Trying to mix it up, you know, make sure that I get a nice wide selection of guests from a different backgrounds. If you've got any thoughts, any suggestions, any feedback, hit me up. I'm always open to it. Love to all that have given me feedback. But yeah, that's another Finding Your Forte. And as always, find your forte, live your forte, and love your forte.
Find your forte.
Live your forte.